Harris versus Thompson.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Allison Flom on behalf of the appellant, Nicole Harris. Your Honors, this case presents an issue at the very heart of the fundamental fairness guaranteed by the Due Process Clause. Did the State of Illinois unreasonably exclude exculpatory eyewitness testimony? Did it gut entirely Nicole Harris's defense to the most heinous charge imaginable? One of two things happened in this case. Either Nicole Harris murdered her child in cold blood, or the child died as the result of an accident, as the state medical examiner originally concluded, and Chicago law enforcement, in their zeal to seek justice for a child they thought had been murdered, extracted a confession to a crime that never occurred. It fell to a Cook County jury to determine which of these two scenarios had actually taken place, in a case with absolutely no physical or scientific evidence. But there was and there is someone who could have told that jury what happened to Jakari Dancy. That's Deontay Dancy, Ms. Harris's older son, who by all accounts was with his brother when he died, and by all accounts told state authorities the very next day that he watched his brother strangle himself while the boys were alone in their room. But no.
When did that interview with, Allie Levy, I wasn't sure how to pronounce the name, but when did that interview take place?
Your Honor, that interview took place at 1400 hours.
The next day.
The very next day. So less
while
than
the mother's
hours.
Still in custody.
That's correct.
Okay.
Your Honor, Ms. Harris presented four issues in her habeas petition, all of which are before this court. But I'd like to focus today on the Sixth Amendment and due process issue represented by the exclusion of the testimony from Deontay Dancy. The record establishes, and here I'm speaking of the very report that Your Honor is referring to, which appears in the separate appendix at page 104 and 105. The record establishes that Deontay Dancy, within 24 hours, reported to state authorities that he observed the following: his brother putting an elastic band from a blue sheet around his own neck while the boys were alone in their room. His brother vomiting. His brother developing a bubble. He also describes trying to help Jakari with the sheet and being unable to. And finally, Deontay describes, from his own perspective, that both boys fell asleep with Jakari on the floor. What the record also establishes is that these details match in every particular the way Jakari, the little boy's body, was found, right down to the color of the blue sheet. So there is no question that Deontay's testimony would have been relevant and material to the defense, such that it is encompassed by the due process right to present witnesses as articulated in Washington versus Texas. And Deontay's testimony was not merely material and relevant, it was exculpatory. And in this case, it was essential because there were no other eyewitnesses, no physical or scientific evidence, and two competing conclusions from the same medical examiner. There was also a highly contested confession, and this is significant as well, Your Honors. The state told the jury in this case that it was, quote, ridiculous, the notion that Jakari could have put a string around his own neck and killed himself. Deontay Dancy would have told that jury that that wasn't ridiculous at all. Deontay Dancy would have told that jury that that's exactly what he saw.
Did he say when he saw that, or was he able to say?
He was able to say, Your Honor, that it occurred on the day Jakari died, when the boys were alone in their room. But he was asked if he could give a particular time frame, and he gave an answer that a six-year-old would reasonably give, not beyond being able to say that it happened on the day that his brother died.
Ms. Flom, could you address specifically the points that the state courts relied upon in concluding that Deontay was not competent? References, I have some in my notes, references to talking with his brother in heaven, saying Santa Claus is real, Spider-Man is real, etc.
Absolutely. I embrace the opportunity to discuss those specifics. But first, Your Honor, some framework with regard to the Illinois Appellate Court and how it encountered this competency issue. The Illinois Competency Statute gives effect to the Due Process Clause and to the Sixth Amendment right to present witnesses in two ways. First, it establishes a presumption of competency. And secondly, it requires a considerable quantum of proof to rebut that presumption. So neither inconsistencies nor imperfections in a witness's testimony will suffice to exclude that witness. The witness must, in the language of the statute in Illinois, be incapable of being understood about the matter at hand. And in the context of child witness testimony, Illinois courts have had repeated occasion to stress the very high bar that these standards establish, and to stress that every witness who is capable of being understood about the essential matter ought to be presented to a jury. Illinois courts in this context routinely admit testimony from 4-, 5-, and 6-year-olds, and in so doing, they evaluate the testimony in a manner that acknowledges the way 4-, 5-, and 6-year-olds talk and think. So these cases tell us that confusion on the part of these witnesses is not only to be expected, but, quote, inevitable. These cases tell us that numerous inconsistencies on the part of these young witnesses are likewise immaterial when it comes to competency. The cases also tell us, here's a quote, several patently inaccurate statements from a child witness also is not troubling from a competency perspective so long as the witness is capable of being understood about the essential details of the incident. So Illinois competency law incorporates what every parent and every child abuse prosecutor knows, which is that child witnesses are children as well as witnesses, that they don't describe things the way adults do, that their vocabulary is limited, that they get distracted, that they don't explain things in a linear way. But they are entitled to the same presumption of competency unless and until they are proven incapable of being understood on the essential matter. So it's against this backdrop, Judge, that I'd like to answer your questions and take up the points that the state points to. And may I also say that we need to establish first the backdrop of what it was that Deontay said at the competency hearing, in addition to what we know he reported to state authorities. Because, again, the competency statute directs us and directs our competency inquiry to what the child was able to say and to what we were able to understand from the child regarding the incident at issue, which clearly is the death of his brother. Here is what Deontay Dancy says at the competency hearing. He describes being in a bedroom, his bedroom, alone with Jakari. He describes playing a video game. He describes that Jakari is, quote, here's the quote, playing with that string and wrapping it around his neck. He describes the string being a cord from a sheet. He describes the sheet as being blue in color. He describes Jakari on the floor. So under the Illinois statute, the question again is what Deontay has presented to us something that we cannot understand with regard to what he is trying to describe? Turning to the state's points here, the state suggests that it is nonetheless reasonable to believe, in light of the competency statute in Illinois and in light of what Deontay clearly expresses about what he saw, the state would have this court believe that Deontay's belief in Santa Claus, or his referring to a church as heaven, or this confusion about rainbow, with the transcript saying rainbow when the next line indicates that he was talking about a car, and he describes that car as a limo, the state suggests that these points of confusion in the testimony of a 6-year-old somehow render us incapable of understanding what that 6-year-old was describing in terms of what he saw his brother do. This is precisely what Illinois competency law tells us not to do, not to become distracted from the question of whether or not the child, the witness, is able to communicate what he actually saw regarding the matter at issue.
There was some testimony, I've forgotten whether it was in the hearing or it might have been one of the interviews, where he said he was asleep when Jakari died.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Can you help me understand the context there?
Absolutely, and I begin where the court does as well, with Deontay's exact words as best we can understand them. They appear in those notes from Allie Levy, the child witness examiner, the state's own child witness examiner, at the separate appendix at page 104 and 105. And what he says is that he was from his perspective, asleep when Deontay died. This is key because the state's characterizations of that statement are quite different. And here I'm referring specifically to, I believe it's the response at page 31. They indicate that what Deontay said was that he was asleep when Jakari was struggling or asleep when Jakari was being strangled. That's not correct. What Deontay tells authorities is, here's what I witnessed. I watched my brother put this string around his neck. I watched him struggle. I tried to help him. And then we both fell asleep, which is a completely reasonable thing for a child to believe. Recall as well in the record that Deontay not only says that he was asleep, he thought Jakari was asleep. And of course it doesn't matter whether or not, from Deontay's perspective, Jakari died after he went to sleep. What matters is what a jury would have understood Deontay to have seen.
The trial judge in the state court seemed to put a lot of weight on testimony. I'm referring to pages 131 and 132 of the appendix, that Deontay could recall nothing else that day and that he had not talked to lawyers before. Could you help us understand those from your perspective?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think that those statements, that there are two separate conclusions there made by the trial court. First, with regard to what Deontay could and could not recall, the trial judge's characterization, I believe what the trial court said was Deontay could only testify about the business of the cord in the neck. We would submit that that's not a reasonable conclusion based on the record. And, of course, the court has before it the entire transcript from the competency hearing, where Deontay tells a great deal more than just business of cord and neck. He describes being in the room alone. He describes the cord being attached to a sheet. He describes the sheet as being blue. He talks about Jakari being on the floor. But even if it were the case that all that Deontay could testify to is that he saw his brother wrap the sheet around his neck, the very instrument of death, that would be tremendously significant. The trial court makes light of this testimony, the business of the cord and the neck. The business of the cord and the neck is precisely why Ms. Harris was convicted. There is no question that that cord around that boy's neck was what caused him to die. So the business of the cord and the neck, absolutely, entirely what this case was about.
During the initial encounter, I guess I would call it, with the police in the, they call it the waiting room or sort of one of the TV in it and stuff. As I understand it, if I read somewhere, that Deontay was sitting on her lap. Is that correct?
There was a point in time, Your Honor, when Ms. Harris was in the room at the police station along with Deontay.
And that was her first discussion. I don't know what was going on, but this is the preliminary sort of where she's describing what went on, I guess. And he was sitting on her lap while that discussion was going on, I presume. And that was like 9 o'clock at night or something, when she first showed up down there. So this is the first discussion, and he was present when this was brought up. Now, we don't know in detail what she said at that point about the cord and what they found and everything else, but he was listening to that. Did that ever come up in his conversation?
He was not ever asked with regard to that, Your Honor, and I don't think the record is entirely clear. Ms. Harris was at the police station for 27 hours total.
No, she was. I know. I'm talking about when he was sitting on her lap and
absolutely.
Then they were talking to him.
Deontay was there until during essentially those first 4 hours. And during those 4 hours, there was periodic questioning. It's not clear.
Did he remember anything about that when he said what went on that day or something?
Was he ever asked, did you overhear any conversations, if that's
no,
the question?
No, I think the judge Hamilton is pointing out, the judge said, well, he didn't remember anything else that day, and then you recited some other things, but at least occurred at some point. I just wondered if he ever mentioned in any of that conversation that he was down there with his mother talking about it.
I don't believe he was asked about that. He did recall going to the hospital that day. And he did indeed go to the hospital with the family. But I also want to address, I think, perhaps a suggestion that one might find inherent in that, in the fact that Deontay was with his family for a period of time. What's significant is that what Deontay tells the state witness examiner. And remember, Deontay is separated from Nicole Harris at 1 a.m. What Deontay tells the state witness examiner is very different than what the law enforcement authorities thought had happened to Jakari at 1 a.m. At 1 a.m., they thought Jakari had been strangled by a telephone cord. So if there is speculation that someone could have told this child, tell someone that your brother was strangled with a sheet and a cord, at that point in time, nobody in law enforcement believed that the sheet was the agent of death. And of course, it's also uncontested that Ms. Harris wasn't the one who found the body of the child. That was the child's father, Stavon Dancy.
Can I ask you a couple more specific questions? There's an assertion that Deontay, during his interview with Dr. Galatzer Levy, admitted lying in his courtroom testimony. Can you explain to us what's going on there? And I hope the state can as well.
Yes, Your Honor, and I also want to address a similar point that Your Honor asked about part two of your previous question.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this goes to Deontay's capacity to honor a witness's obligation to tell the truth. Again, here the backdrop is significant. What the district court found is that here the state court's inversion of the presumption with regard to witness competency was dispositive. The state court found stated five separate times in its ruling regarding this prong of Deontay's competency, his ability to honor an obligation to tell the truth. The state court found on five separate occasions that it didn't have enough information one way or another because nobody had asked this child during voir dire whether or not he did understand the obligation of a witness's ability to tell the truth. So in light of those deficits in the record, the default ought to have been to competency. Now, the state attempts to rescue that error by suggesting that there are some pieces of affirmative evidence that Deontay was an avowed liar or incapable of telling the truth, constitutionally incapable of telling the truth. We would submit that those are unreasonable readings of both the voir dire record and the interview with Dr. Galitzer Levy. Taking first what came up in the voir dire, Your Honor's first question, what the larger record indicates, and again, we urge the court to read all of these statements in context. What questions were asked, what questions on cross-examination were asked of this 6-year-old, both before and after. That line of inquiry begins with, Deontay, before you came to court today, and then there are a series of sub-questions, and one of them is, have you spoken to any of these people in the room? Deontay answers no to that. And the indication is and the argument is that indicates that Deontay is somehow an inherently unreliable, untrustworthy character because he answers no to that confusing question. But even if it were the case that 6-year-old Deontay understood that he was being asked not just about that day, but if he had ever had a conversation with the other people in the room, it's not the case that witnesses who are erroneous or even proven to be materially inaccurate, that they are prevented from testifying. We don't strike the testimony of a witness any time he is impeached. We would submit that these are not unfair points for the state to make at a trial with regard to how Deontay's testimony ought to be evaluated, but they do not rise to the level of incompetency, particularly where Deontay is asked, is it a good thing or a bad thing to tell the truth? A good thing, he says. Is it a bad thing to tell the lie? A bad thing, he says. And Illinois courts tell us that exact exchange is an acceptable proxy for a child's understanding of the witness obligation to tell the truth. And with regard to Dr.
Gale, go ahead. Were you cutting to something else I had asked you?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I just was going to answer the part of your question regarding to the Dr. Galitzer Levy interview.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It seems that, and again, the larger context there indicates that Dr. Galitzer Levy asked Deontay, is there ever a time when you haven't been truthful? Notably before that, Dr. Galitzer Levy has a conversation with Deontay where he again says, I know that telling the truth is a good thing. I know that when I promise to tell the truth, I'm supposed to. And Dr. Galitzer Levy says, almost just as an open question, was there ever a time you didn't tell the truth? And Deontay says, in court.
In church.
In church.
The church with the judge.
Exactly. And Deontay says, yes. And then the next thing Deontay says is, I didn't remember a lot of stuff. So it seems at least a fair interpretation that what Deontay was saying is I couldn't tell them everything because I didn't know everything. And the fact, Your Honor, that we're even speculating here, again, shows that this is the kind of question that goes to the weight of this testimony, not its admissibility. This, the kind of guessing that we're speculating in would have been absolutely fair game for a jury, but a jury ought to have also heard Deontay describe what he saw the day his brother died.
Ms. Long, could I just ask a couple of other brief questions? I'm sorry, but if you could answer briefly, is it correct that the first version of Ms. Harris's confession was inconsistent with the physical evidence about the reasons for his death?
Yes, Your Honor. And notably, though, it is consistent with what law enforcement believed had happened at that point in time. But
ultimately needed to be corrected in the further conversations with the police. All right. And then finally, on your ineffective assistance of counsel claim, Ms. or Mr. Levy, who did the first interview with Deontay, was under subpoena, apparently.
That was the representation made by trial counsel.
Do we know what happened?
Mm-hmm.
Does
all
the
we
record
know,
tell us?
The record doesn't tell us, Your Honor.
Okay.
All the record tells us is that defense counsel represented that she was under subpoena and then withdrew her testimony. So it's significant that this conversation that we've spent a great deal of time discussing, the trial court had no idea that it occurred. The trial court never heard from Ms. Levy. The trial court never saw the notes that are in the separate appendix at page 104 and 105. And so the trial court made a determination without the benefit of any of that information because trial counsel never brought it forward.
Just one other question. In your research and preparing for this trial, did you examine the requirements in other states for what types of questions satisfy the do you know the truth from not the truth and so forth?
There certainly is a line of cases in Illinois, Your Honor, that ask that question specifically with regard to child witnesses. And what those line of cases say, and these are cited in our brief, is that it is not required of a child witness that a child witness demonstrate an abstract understanding of a concept like truth or even a concept like witness, just that the child be in a position to, as a practical matter, know that he's supposed to tell the truth and know that he's not supposed to lie. Specifically, there's a case that discusses an exchange with a child that's almost identical to the one that's in the record here. This is People versus Mack, which is also cited in our brief. And what happens in that case and what the Illinois courts deemed sufficient in that case was exactly the exchange that happened with Deontay in the voir dire here. The witness indicated that the witness knew it was a good thing to tell the truth and a bad thing to tell a lie. And the Illinois courts have determined that to be sufficient to establish competency in a child.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Erin O'Connell on behalf of the respondent warden. The defendant, or the petitioner in this case, is vastly overstating her case by claiming that Deontay was an eyewitness to his brother's death. The record is clear on two points. The first point is that Deontay was asleep when his brother died. The second point is that the incident that he described, in which he saw his brother putting the string, playing with the string, happened earlier that same day. The points at which in the record, the evidence shows that Deontay was sleeping. It's not just one place. He testified at the competency hearing. Yes, I told the state investigators that I was asleep when he died. This is at the supplemental appendix at 127. In the notes of Levy's interview again, Deontay was sleeping when Jakari died. This is at page 105 of the supplemental appendix. He reconfirmed this same fact in Dr. Galitzer Levy's post-trial interview at 183. He states that Dr. Galitzer Levy is trying to draw out of him kind of the sequence of events, and Deontay states, "I didn't see what happened. I was still asleep." Furthermore, at the competency hearing, Deontay was unable to place in any sort of chronological context when he saw his brother playing with the string, and this was a cause for the trial court's concern. However, outside of the competency hearing, he has repeatedly made clear that the time that he saw this happen was before petitioner went to the laundromat came back home, saw the boys outside, and disciplined them.
And you're talking about the playing with the elastic band?
Correct.
It was before that incident, and then they went outside and did he talk anything about a spanking?
Exactly. And
he did?
Say again.
Did he say something about his mother spanking him?
He did, yes. He has reaffirmed that in Dr. Gallatz's release.
And that was after the so-called playing with the elastic?
Yes. And so in Dr. Gallatz's release interview at 179, it says, Deontay says, first he put the sheet around his neck, then they went outside, and then they got in trouble. Again at 184, Dr. Gallatz's release again is having trouble kind of pinning him down on the chronology. When you went to sleep, he had this, did he have it around his neck? Answer, uh-uh. Question, no, uh-uh. It was off of him when we got in trouble. The evidence could not be clearer that he is describing an incident that occurred before the parents left and came back and disciplined.
What do you make of the testimony about the bubbles that he saw?
Well, it's actually undisputed that he could not have seen the bubble under either theory, because the bubble allegedly occurred after he fell asleep. So it was this was secondhand. He was asleep before Deontay was dead. Stevan came back and he described seeing Jakari there with a bubble in his nose. Now
that's the father when he came back in after dropping off the laundry, and then he finds him apparently, and that's where the bubble. At that time, he was dead, and father found him.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And I know Your Honor had a question for me.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just wanted to clarify that.
Didn't I? Correct. Neglect to answer a question?
Go ahead.
Oh, and I'm going to rely temporarily on the notes of Allie Levy's interview.
You had indicated that he couldn't see the bubble. There was no...
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. Yes. What we know is that he was asleep before this happened, but we also know that he was at the hospital with Stevan and Petitioner before the police had taken them to the police station, and he admits that he had discussed this event with Stevan. And other information that he has given in Dr. Gallatz Levy's interview shows that he has internalized or sort of made part of his own recollection things that Stevan has told him. He also says that he claims to know that Stevan and Petitioner took steps, were unable to find the ambulance, and therefore had to call for help. There's no dispute whatsoever that Deontay was not there when that happened. He had to learn that from either Stevan or Petitioner.
Can we back up a second, Ms. O'Connell? If I got this right, is the state's theory that Deontay is asleep through the entire time that Ms. Harris hears Jakari crying so much that she's enraged that she can't quiet him down, comes into the room through all this screaming, and strangles her son while the other one is asleep?
I don't think the record is clear that he was screaming. You have the correct sequence of events, but the evidence was not that he was, you know, hollering.
But it was the crying that provoked her to try to shut him up with the cord.
Correct.
Is that the state's theory, right?
Yes,
based
that
on
he
her
was
confession.
Asleep. Sorry.
That based he on was, her confession.
Mm-hmm. Correct. That he was asleep when Jakari was crying. Yes.
Deontay went to sleep and Jakari was crying and wouldn't be quiet.
Correct. They were both in their bunk beds, their respective upper and lower bunks.
Does that seem a little improbable?
No, Your Honor. We know that even if this was accidental, Deontay slept through it. Even if Jakari is there wrapping this around his own neck and struggling, we know that Deontay was asleep. I mean, the fair inference is that Deontay was a fairly heavy sleeper, if that's the case.
Sounds like an extraordinarily heavy sleeper. Mm-hmm.
that he would, well, we, if he's asleep while his brother is struggling and asphyxiating, then he would
not. If he's asphyxiated, he can't make much noise. But the state's theory is that he was crying so loudly that it enraged his mother to the point that she silenced him by strangling him to death.
That's correct. That's what she stated in her confession, yes. To be clear, we're not actually, as defendant petitioner represents in her reply brief, we're not claiming that Deontay ever saw Jakari in his death throes at any point. We're not claiming that at some point earlier this day, he wrapped it around his neck and Deontay was there, saw him vomit, saw all of this happen. And then after that, then, you know, he recovered and petitioner came back in. The evidence that he saw any of this asphyxiation is limited entirely to the two-page document of Allie Levy's notes. These are unauthenticated documents, and it's important to note that Deontay has never at any point reaffirmed that he ever saw Jakari vomiting. It is frankly unreasonable to rely on this document as evidence of what Deontay's testimony would have been when we have his competency hearing testimony and we have two lengthy interviews by Dr. Galitzer Levy in which he was asked repeatedly to try to clarify the sequence of events. Never in either of those places did Deontay claim that he saw this vomiting, that he tried to help him get out of the cord. There, I don't know the exact explanation as to why these appear in the notes, but as Your Honor noted, Deontay was at the police station through petitioner's initial questioning. He was also at the hospital talking to his father, Stavon, and petitioner, and at that time presumably could have gotten these additional details.
Ms. O'Connell, could I direct you to pages 131 and 132 of the appendix? It's part of the questioning by the court during the competency hearing. As I understand the state's position, and the state court's position is that the answer on 132, do you remember anything else that happened that day? No. Question, nothing at all. No. And the answer, have you spoken before with any of the people who are here today before you came to court? Answer, no. That those are really critical pieces of evidence in showing that Deontay was incompetent to testify.
They're critical in finding him incompetent under one prong of the Illinois competency statute, that he was unable to understand the importance of the oath given to witnesses.
Okay. Was there any follow-up? I mean, frankly, look, we're talking about a six-year-old. And the question, have you spoken before with any of the people who are here today before you came to court, is compound by the number of people in the court, and potentially confusing even to fairly sophisticated adult witnesses. And just saying no without any follow-up as evidence that this child is incapable, of, given all the other things that he's talked about, that he's incapable of testifying is frankly troubling.
I agree with Your Honor that the question is compound and that it would have been better to clarify after that. It's telling that Deontay admitted in his interview with Dr. Galitzer Levy that there was a point at the competency hearing where he did not tell the truth.
And then said, I didn't remember stuff, right?
He did go on and say, I didn't remember stuff.
That's pretty common for a lot of adult witnesses, right? Mm-hmm.
To not remember?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. And we're not arguing that he was incompetent just based on a failure to remember.
Okay. And then was there anything more supporting the district or the trial judge's finding there on the unable to give an account than this exchange on 132 about not remembering anything else that happened that day?
That was the court's concern about his ability to narrate the events of the day that the incident occurred.
Mm-hmm.
But there was also playing into this is, was Deontay able to distinguish between what he perceived and what he recalled as a witness and fantasy or information that he had received secondhand via hearsay? And there, the record at the competency hearing is replete with his believing that fantasy characters were real.
Well, that's, I mean, that testimony is pretty confusing in the sense that he was first asked to distinguish between cartoons and real, and then the context seemed to shift in cross between true and fictional, right? So that at least those of us, well, some of us remember Spider-Man as just a cartoon in the original books, but by this time he was a, quote, real figure played by an actor in a movie.
Right? I would direct the court's attention to the exchange that he had with the prosecutor regarding seeing his brother in heaven, mm-hmm. where he states, I mean, one aspect of this testimony that petitioner cannot explain is that he stated that he saw Jakari and that Jakari told him at the time that his mother had killed him. And there is no ambiguity in the record about what brother they were discussing.
Where is that?
It's at page 125.
Okay.
It said, and did you talk to Jakari then? Uh-huh. Did he say anything to you? Yes. What did he say to you? He said my mommy killed my brother and my mommy didn't.
Does that make sense as he being my brother?
Jakari being?
Wouldn't it make more sense he said my mommy killed me?
I mean, Your Honor is noting that his testimony is very difficult to construe. And this was certainly something that gave the trial judge pause.
Right. Which, and frankly, what gives me pause is how could counsel effectively question this child in court without having talked to him first, without having gotten some expert advice. I mean, this is the case, right? Given the confession, he's your only potential witness on the defense side. How do you go in cold?
It's actually not clear how trial counsel judged the significance of his testimony. I mean, after post-trial, petitioner has maintained that this was critical to her defense. However, as stated, he was not actually an eyewitness to the death, and counsel may well have had a strategic reason for not even necessarily wanting to call him as a witness. We really don't know much about what counsel was thinking with respect to Deontay.
Could I ask you, this issue of competency of a child comes up a lot. It comes up a lot, I imagine, for your office, particularly in defending convictions for child molestation where young victims have testified.
Yes.
Right? That's where a lot of these cases that the petitioner is talking about are coming from.
Exactly.
On this record, given the testimony that Deontay provided, do you think it would have been an abuse of discretion if the trial judge had come out the other way and had found him competent to testify?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, the reason there is an abuse of discretion standard is that the competency determination turns on aspects of demeanor that are not evident from the cold record. We know the trial judge, in finding him incompetent, was very concerned that he had extremely long pauses before answering questions. If the record had been different, if the court had not had such concerns based on demeanor, and if there had been some evidence that he was competent, then it's completely possible.
You don't think there was any evidence that he was competent?
At best, the evidence is ambiguous. And that is unfortunate for a petitioner here in this habeas proceeding. The trial court made its determination. The appellate court at the state level defers to the trial court's determination because of this concern with the cold record not being a complete replication of what was before the court. And now here in this habeas proceeding, this court must defer to the state appellate court's determination. And as we stated, this is actually a factual determination for purposes of habeas. A witness's competency is a factual determination under 2254E1. That means that here, petitioner must present this court with clear and convincing evidence that Deontay was competent. She has failed to do so. At best, the evidence that she has submitted is equivocal. I mean, he repeatedly denied to Dr. Gallitzer-Levy that he understood the difference between the truth and a lie, He denied that he understood the meaning of a promise. I mean, this does not clearly and convincingly show that the trial court erred in finding that he failed to appreciate the significance of the oath given to witnesses. Nor has petitioner submitted clear and convincing evidence that he could properly recollect what had transpired and narrate that intelligently. The interviews with Dr. Galitzer Levy are frankly the best evidence that the trial court was correct, because they show that he has extreme difficulty expressing himself even as to extremely simple matters. When asked, what pets do you have at home? Who do they belong to? Where did you get your Spider-Man toy? These are simple questions that a child witness should have no problems with. He was unable to give clear answers to Dr. Galitzer Levy on these simple matters. And Dr. Galitzer Levy had to go to great efforts to try to draw out of him what the sequence of events were. And as noted, Dr. Galitzer Levy succeeded in establishing that he was asleep when his brother died and that he had seen his brother wrapping the string around his neck earlier in the day.
I have a separate question. I know this is a habeas petition, but if some event this were case had to be tried over again, Deontay's, what, 12 now or so?
Probably.
Yeah. I just wonder if anybody's talked to him now about his reflection of what, how he would translate what he sort of remembers back then, how he would translate it now.
The state, I know, hasn't spoken to him, and the petitioner, as far as I can tell, has just been relying on the interviews by Dr. Galitzer Levy that were shortly after trial.
I'm just wondering about that issue, though, because if obviously we all think back when we were maybe six when something happened and reflect back on it now, and we know better what happened than what we may have perceived then.
Well, what we know is that if he were to testify today, he would testify that he was asleep when Jakari died.
Okay. How do we know that?
Mm-hmm.
Because he stated that repeatedly. And because of that, even if the trial court erred in finding him incompetent, the petitioner has failed to show that this was had a prejudicial effect on her conviction, because he was not an eyewitness. He would have marginally helped the accident theory by reaffirming what Savan already stated, that Jakari had a habit of playing with this string.
Well, there was testimony that the decedent was beaten or whipped or whatever, right?
That was in petitioner's confession, and then Savan testified. He didn't witness it. He testified that he heard the yelling at the time.
Well, he was... I'm sorry.
Well, my point was there was some... Also, some he had said that she killed you. Right. I mean, something to that effect. He changed it.
All right, by he, you're referring to Deontay?
Yes.
I'm not sure if this is the point Your Honor is getting at, but that Deontay's testimony would have been prejudicial to the petitioner because he gave an extensive account of the beatings that occurred that she denied in her trial testimony. That is correct.
Is there somebody named Bobby in this? I know it wasn't discussed about the confession and everything else, but I got the impression that now Bobby, or whoever that was, I assume he was a detective, was supposed to have cautioned her to say, well, if you say the right things, you only get, I don't know, voluntary manslaughter or something.
The prosecutor assumed, I believe, that she was referring to Detective Robert Cordaro. So the prosecutor called Detective Cordaro in rebuttal to rebut this claim that Bobby had allegedly coached her to give testimony. So that would be, as far as I know, the only potential Bobby in the case.
Okay.
And he denied doing so.
Okay.
I see my time is up. If the court has no questions, we would ask you to affirm the district court.
Thank you. Also for the other... I wasn't quite worried about that. I wonder if my colleagues had any other questions.
If we could give a minute or two rebuttal, perhaps, just to see if there's anything. So.
I will be brief. I'm mindful that we're over time here. I'll say only this, that there are questions that are being raised with regard to how we ought to interpret the various things that Deontay said. And with regard to that, I ask the court to refer to the entire record, not to my characterizations and not to the state's characterizations. We embrace the entire record here in terms of understanding, first of all, precisely what it is the boy said, and secondly, the context for all of those statements. And the final point I'd like to make is related to this, related to the debate that we're having about what and how we should evaluate some of these questions, when it was that Deontay may have fallen asleep, who might have spoken to him, and when. Those are questions that would have been fair game for the jury and ought to have been presented to the jury and go rightly to the weight. But they do not support a finding of incompetency. And to the extent they can be suggested as reasons for finding the exclusion harmless, the trial lawyer in me knows that even with all of this, in light of all of this, rainbows, limos, and all, Deontay's words would have been the first out of my mouth in opening and the last out of my mouth in closing. Was he a perfect witness? Of course not. He's 6 years old. But what he describes explains to you that Ms. Harris is innocent. I am mindful that that claim of innocence has no bearing here.
That's the same question, though. That if this, for whatever reason, if it ended up having to be retried, would Deontay be testifying?
I'm sorry, Your
Honor? Would Deontay be testifying at age 12 if this had to be retried?
Certainly he would be called as a witness to the extent he might need to be refreshed by some of his prior statements. That's certainly a possibility. But absolutely, Deontay would have been and would be the heart and soul of the case going forward. But significantly, too, not the only evidence that suggests that Ms. Harris's confession was false, and not the only evidence that suggests that that Jakari's death was accidental. This relates to the ineffective assistance claim somewhat. There was a great deal of evidence that this jury never heard with regard to how it's possible for young children to strangle themselves, with regard to how it's possible for a person to falsely confess. The videotape that this court has seen, those 18 minutes of Ms. Harris's final confession, doesn't show you the previous 27 hours of custodial interrogation. That too would have been the focus of this trial. So Deontay is essential, but he would not have been alone in presenting evidence in support of Ms. Harris's innocence and in support of the medical examiner's original conclusion in this case that Jakari died as the result of an accident. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.